Y'all went into Grenada for 40, 170, not 500 medical students. And here there are thousands of blacks being persecuted, killed, death squads, and you're not doing anything. Clearly, Haiti is no more or less in the interest of the United States than Grenada. So what you have, for example, a leading editor of a paper in the Delaware Valley asked their reporters to come down and talk to me and said, why is Biden so concerned about Bosnia and not about Haiti? Is it because blacks are involved in Haiti? Blacks are what at stake in Haiti and in Bosnia. They are Europeans, whites. There is that notion abroad in the Congress, in the country. It's not substantially different than when Lech Walesa came along and all the polls in the state of Delaware and the United States of America focused, or when Israel is in trouble and the American Jewish community and those who believe strongly in Israel focus. Or you can list throughout our history circumstances where our multi-ethnic community looks to things happening in a constituency that they are from, represent, or feel having a stake in.
All right, everybody.
Haiti just quietly sunk into the Caribbean or rose up 300 feet. It wouldn't matter a whole
but
lot.
But doesn't the world and...
Hey. I mean, the Biden stuff is just too good. It's an extremely rich clip. Anytime you see Biden talking about another country, something devastating is soon to happen. But anyways, not to get distracted. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of Left Reckoning. My name is David Griscom, joined as always by my good friend Matt Leck. How's it going, brother?
It's going well. We got to figure out how to do this intro music thing smoothly on the new system. But other than that, David, it's going fairly well today. My other job got written up by Mediaite today for a libertarian saying that the Surfside condo people had it coming. So it's been an interesting day. I mean, that it's funny now, but actually if people listen back to the... they'll find out I was angry. But anyway, now I'm in a better mindset. Joe Biden... Let's talk about this. Let's talk about Joe Biden and this posture he has on Charlie Rose as if they regularly take a hands-off approach to Haiti. You know, obviously the news, Jovenel Moïse killed last night, assassinated by death squads, it appears. It's very unclear now in speculation. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll get into some of the crazier speculation later. You know, in the... previous months, there'd been all this talk about death squads in Haiti and the idea that Moïse was controlling and directing some of them.
Well, he certainly was.
Absolutely was. And when you get into bed with people like that, what happens when things start turning? Back to Biden saying we have this hands-off approach to Haiti. Not technically true. You know, they're interested in Bosnia, but they're also interested in Haiti. The IMF in 1995, and I should have looked up when exactly. That looked like the 90s. In 1995, forced the nationalization of 9 industries in Haiti. Then the Clinton administration itself... pressured Haiti to drop rice and sugar tariffs. This had the effect of forcing agricultural workers into textile factories. Fast forward, you know, a lot of political history to the Obama administration, 2010. The Chelsea Manning cables revealed that the U.S. had the ambassador lean on President Rene Préval to achieve a tax carve-out for a minimum wage law that had just been passed unanimously that wanted to raise the minimum wage from something like 29 cents to 61 cents an hour or thereabouts. And that was on behalf of Haynes and Levi and companies like that. So after those workers had been forced off. And there's another thing where the devastating earthquake in 2010. And in this time since, Haiti has basically, and I'm not sure if this was the case beforehand, but the number one NGOs per capita, they get 51% of their food imported, and it's 50% of people are malnourished. So you look at the impacts of what this is happening. And, you know, Biden was propping up Moïse just as Moise, we looked this up beforehand, just as Trump did. And, you know, I mean, this is a bipartisan effort, basically, to support. Yeah. We're going to stop supporting dictatorship in your country. But what that means, what our democracy is going to be exploitation by our corporations.
And we're going to handpick your leaders, too.
Exactly. Yeah.
I want to get back to the history and all of this in a second, but just for folks who aren't familiar, very briefly, what has happened since this morning? So this is still a very fluid situation. There has been a successful assassination attempt against Moise, who was murdered in his house. And we'll get into in a second a little bit of who that may have been. But he was murdered in his house. His wife was also shot. She has now been brought to the United States, where she is receiving medical treatment. But just to give folks a little bit of context, since mid-February, there have been massive protests against Moise because he has refused to abdicate his position as president. And this isn't even a situation, right, like what we've been seeing in other countries where, he's going to start claiming election fraud or things like that. There's been a refusal to have any form of democracy in the country. Right now, Haiti is a country where the vast majority of democratically elected positions are sitting empty. Moise has waged war against the courts. I believe there's only now 10 sitting senators. The assembly is all but dissolved. And Moise has been cracking down on these protests, basically saying, we want to return to civilian rule. We want to return to democracy. He has cracked down on these, or he did crack down on these, with brutal, brutal tactics. In fact, he created an organization, the NIA, which is, basically an organization of thugs that do his bidding. They have incredible police powers of both surveillance and arrest, and also the ability to murder people. And they have legal protection from being, tried for any of their crimes against folks, right? So people have been showing up in protest against the government, and they have been met with brutal, brutal crackdowns. And of course, in this kind of scenario, there's a lot of different factions and people who are trying to fill power vacuums, that come up basically when you have the state trying to assert itself against all other parts of society. So now with Moise dead, the question as to who or what organization will be leading the country is very, very much in flux. It's no help that there was supposed to be a new prime minister stepping up today. So there's going to be a lot of questions about the future of Haiti. And, so this is one of those moments where it's tough to talk too much broadly as things are very much unfolding on the ground. But I wanted to note just a couple of quick threads that people should be paying attention to. One of the big scandals regarding Moise is not only the fact that he has been refusing democracy in the country, but this massive corruption scandal in Haiti. As Matt was noting, the incredible amounts of money that come into the country through NGOs and also through international donations, things of that nature. But most notably, the Petrocaribe scandal, which I don't know if you're too familiar with this, Matt, but Venezuela in its attempt to help out the people of Haiti, right? Continuing that long tradition of solidarity between anti-imperialist countries, Venezuela provided extremely cheap oil to Haiti, around $4 billion, right? Where Haiti was only supposed to pay a very small amount of money up front. And the rest of the money was supposed to be set aside to create projects that would help out the working people in Haiti. The vast majority of that money has been embezzled. And people are asking, where is this money? What is going on here? And that significant scandal has been at the center here. And it's worth noting that, when Venezuela is doing stuff like that, the United States has been illicitly trying to prop up dictators. Biden, throughout all of these protests and throughout all of these scandals, has stood very, very firmly with Moise. It's one of those moments where a lot of people do get confused, because typically when you see an assassination, you want to point your fingers directly at the United States. I wouldn't even go as far as to say that there might not be an American role in this, by the way. But it is important to remember that Moise is somebody who was very much propped up and protected by the Biden administration and by the U.S. government. Remember, before this, Martelli, who was the president, was also propped up by Hillary Clinton and the OAS, right? So the United States plays an extremely active role in Haiti. And there's lots of reasons for it. One, the United States wants to exert its hegemony in the Caribbean. Two, Haiti is a very, very dangerous example of a country that has a radically different trajectory. Haiti is where all of the ideas of the Enlightenment and all of like European philosophy came into direct contradiction with the realities of imperialism and capitalism. Haiti, for folks who aren't familiar, and I hope most people listening to this are, was the first successful mass slave revolt. People should definitely read the great book, that should be said time and time again by C.L.R. James, Black Jacobins, which really asserts this critical moment, not just in North American history, but in human global history that was represented by the Haitian Revolution. So Haiti is a very dangerous like idea to the United States. But most notably, as Matt was mentioning earlier, it's labor. It's having access to extremely cheap labor that is critical to American corporations and to the American imperial project in the region, which is why anytime any kind of left-wing government has approached power in Haiti, it has been met with brutal American crackdowns, including assassinations. So what we're seeing right now is a very clear demand from the Haitian people for democracy. And people are taking it into their own hands quite literally. In many parts of the country, people are self-organizing and trying to organize their communities and their streets to basically face what looks like a potential state failure. The threat here that we have to be watching out for is power vacuum and the United States entrance as the kingmaker, right? That is the biggest threat and the biggest fear right now is the Biden administration comes in and says, here's a rocky situation. The United States is going to come in with the military and take control of this situation. And then they're going to pick the next leader and continue this vicious cycle.
Right.
And just last thing, just so I remember everything from my notes, people should definitely check out the work of Kim Ives at Haiti Liberté. He was a guest on TMBS a few times. Did I give this to you, Matt? Yep. It's fine if not. He, in his most recent piece, which came up today, which is about some of the horrible massacres that we've been seeing in Haiti over the past week, where 32 people were murdered at a demonstration. Kim Ives said at the beginning of this piece, because it came out right as this news was breaking, that he believes in the feeling is for most people there that the professional nature of this hit against Moise and the knowledge that they had to have to take out this attack suggests that one, they had an inside accomplice and also the scale and sophistication of the operation suggests that it was a well-financed and well-planned operation and not a spontaneous one, which is really important for people to understand in light of the fact that there have been massive street protests for so long in the country, that this is something that was funded and planned out. And, you know, the questions as to who or what organizations are behind it are very much in flux, but people should have that knowledge in their heads, you know, going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe we'll play that CLR James clip in the post game.
Okay, cool.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to note, I know we started a little bit late. I just wanted to do a quick pitch and also sort of set the episode up so folks know.
All right.
We're going to be joined in just a moment by our good friend, Austin Gonzalez, to talk about DSA's international delegations, both to Peru and Venezuela. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Talk a little bit about what was seen and learned from those trips and also about their importance for, here domestically as we build an American left here. Hopefully we'll also have time to read a piece by our favorite Miami Herald columnist, Andreas Oppenheimer. And after that, we're going to be talking a little bit about some really serious, revelations and also Julian Assange. And also be sure to join us for the post game where we're going to be watching an old clip of all of us at TMBS and Michael's commentary on Haiti and CLR James.
There's Donnie Deutsch. There's a lot of stuff that's very interesting in the post game. Some of it's very enlightening. Some of it's really objectionable and irritating. and we'll be responding to all of it.
It'll be a good time. All right. Well, we'll see you all in a little bit. We'll be right back with Austin.
We are back. Welcome back to Left Reckoning. David Griscom, Matt Leck. Joining us, I believe maybe the first returning guest of Left Reckoning, actually, now that I think about it. And it couldn't go to a more knowledgeable guest, Austin Gonzalez of Machete Mate podcast, one of my favorites for the topics that we're going to be discussing this evening. Austin, welcome back.
Happy to be back and very honored to be your first repeat guest. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. No,
we're thrilled to have you, especially such a jet set guest. Austin's going to talk to us a little bit about these DSA delegations to both Peru and Venezuela. I just wanted to note that I don't have my props with me right now, that Left Reckoning is still very much firmly a pencils out podcast.
Oh, yes.
We were all very excited, and I'm still very inspired by Pedro Castillo's victory, though, as we've been watching, unfortunately, there's still a lot of question marks about it. The results of the election are not in question at all, but the fervor of the right wing and whether or not the Western imperial powers are going to play ball with the Peruvian right wing is very much a large question. Could you talk about Keiko Fujimori's sort of refusal to accept Pedro Castillo's election results?
Absolutely. So a little bit of background here. As you mentioned, I went to Peru to observe their elections on behalf of the Democratic Socialists of America, right? I'm a member of both the National Political Committee of DSA as well as their International Committee. That was kind of like the basis for our delegation. And we worked in collaboration with a couple other groups that do this regularly, including the Progressive International, as well as the Party of the European Left, and a couple other ones. Sao Paulo Forum was there as well, a couple different groups that do election observing. We met with a lot of different groups down there, and the common theme from groups that we would meet with, human rights orgs, political parties, you know, social movements, the common theme was a fear that regardless of whether or not Castillo would win, that the right wing would try to steal this election in a few different ways, one of which is manifesting itself as we speak, as you've referenced. The two biggest concerns that election observers had, and not just us, but once again, human rights organizations on the ground that we talked to, was one, we feared a situation like what happened in Bolivia in 2019 for their coup, which is to say that Peru, much like Bolivia, has rural communities that lean heavily toward Pedro Castillo in this case, Evo in Bolivia's case, but rural communities whose votes come in later, right? So there was a concern that the urban vote would come in first. And because the urban vote would come in first, Keiko would just declare victory. Mm. Now, luckily that did not happen. But for anybody who was sitting on pins and needles on election day, it was very tight. And the urban vote did come in first. And it was, once again, people were a little worried that something like that would happen. The second concern is the one that is manifesting itself right now, which is that the margin would be so razor thin, which we all knew it was going to be very, very tight, but that the margin would be so razor thin that Keiko and the right wing would do what they're doing right now, which is attempt to death by a thousand cuts, right? Muddy up the process, attempt to scrutinize as many votes as possible, find very similar to Donald Trump and Stop the Steal, right? Try and find instances of maybe bureaucratic incompetence, right? And say, this is systemic fraud. You see, they cheated us, even though this is, once again, any example. They've not given any examples of systematic fraud. That's the bottom line. They've not given any actual examples of them, of Peru Libre, once again, which it boggles my mind how they would somehow rig the election, even though the right wing's in power in Peru. But that's a whole other conversation entirely, I suppose. But this is a very real fear. And this is a very real concern from the activists on the ground in Peru that that they're going to stop Castillo from getting inaugurated. Now, I don't know, asking my opinion, right? I don't know that that they'll successfully be able to coup him before he takes office. Mm-hmm. But it's terrifying that we even have to have this conversation, right? And as soon as we left Peru, our friends on the ground, the unions we met with, the activist groups we met with, were giving us alarm bells almost immediately, saying, hey, this is very concerning, right? And this is despite the OAS putting out a statement saying, hey, these elections were clean. Let's chill out, Keiko, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is despite that. They've still, like, the media in Peru is so deeply right wing. They've been in lockstep with Keiko the whole time. Mm-hmm. So for our comrades on the ground in Peru, all they see is the Peruvian media saying, oh, yeah, you see fraud. Oh, my goodness, this guy Castillo. Whereas there's an interesting dynamic where that the international community just kind of sees, once again, these OAS reports or what the U.S. State Department put out, which have mostly been like, oh, we should respect the results. In Peru, completely different. And that's why people are very afraid that there could that there might be some sort of preemptive coup to stop Castillo. Like I said, maybe I'm optimistic. I don't know. I think I want to. It's like I said, it scares me that I'm even this uncertain because of, once again, how tight the vote margin is. But I mean, we'll see. This is a developing story fully.
Well, for sure. I will say, you know, one thing that does give me a little bit of confidence is just because papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times already have like a grammar and a logic to report on this. Basically, they're saying, oh, he's doing a Trump. They've immediately taken a posture against Keiko, which is, you know, very beneficial. I'm very happy to see.
And sorry, real quick, this is the, should I say benefit, right? Of having your opposition be led by a literal political criminal, right?
Yeah.
Keiko was literally in prison just last year. She was on house arrest in Lima and could barely campaign. So that's another dynamic entirely. In fact, a lot of the average Peruvians we spoke to, they would talk about the corruption, right? They would say, I'm supporting Castillo because we do not want the Fujimorismo, right? That's a legacy of corruption in Peru.
Yeah, you mentioned, I'm Machete Mate, that the negative partisanship angle was very pronounced in Lima, especially. Like, it was anti-Fujimori and anti-Castillo. Can you just speak to that a little bit and how it differs from the actual outside Lima?
100%. Negative campaigning was now, to be clear, I spent all my time in Lima. So all I saw was the negative campaigning. I wish I could have gone to the rural communities where it was a very different dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you just look at the vote in cities like Ayacucho, which are in the rural areas, 80% for Pedro Castillo. My God, that's an insane margin. But yes, as you mentioned, in Lima, it's funny. As soon as I landed in Lima, there were two hilarious things that I saw almost immediately. The first hilarious thing that I saw immediately, as soon as we got off the plane, you know how at the airport you'll see people holding up signs for, oh, I'm your chauffeur for whatever. There was literally somebody with a sign that said OAS, right? OAS. Mm. So that was just hilarious to see. Oh, great. The OAS is on the scene to steal the election. That's fun. Although, yeah, luckily that did not happen. But the second thing that was super hilarious that we saw almost immediately, the first political billboard we saw, which it said it was big, bold letters. 5 days to vote no to communism, right?
Wow.
And that was Keiko's campaign, totally negative, which is this is a senderista, the shining path of the communists. We need to stop them. This is unacceptable, right? And as you referenced, Matt, and as I referenced a little bit earlier, the people we talked to in Lima and the average people, right? Not just not the political parties. Obviously, the political parties had a much more, I suppose, robust reason for supporting SEO. The average people, right? We made it a mission to talk to our cab drivers, right? Who are you voting for? There's a really big election coming up, right? You got to have some sort of opinions. Every single one of them, except for one, said, I'm supporting Castillo, and the reason is because of the corruption, right? Because of the corruption of people like Keiko Fujimori. That message, that campaign slogan, no más pobres en un país rico, right? No more poverty in a rich country, that resonated. And it's true. You know, we talk on Machete Mate, my podcast, all the time about how Peru is one of those countries that's, it's like a sleeping giant, right? This is the former seat of the Inca Empire. It should be like in the G20 or whatever, and actually like a country that doesn't have such a stratified society between rich and poor, between indigenous and, you know, I don't know, Spaniard descended, whatever we want to call it, right? Criollo, whatever word we want to use. So it's that message truly it was clear to me, at least, that message resonated to the average Peruvian. So that the dynamics in Lima are unique in that, once again, Lima is also a pro-Keiko stronghold. Keiko dominated in Lima. So it was still fascinating to see how many average people still supported Castillo despite all of that in Lima.
No, that, I mean, it is absolutely fascinating. And I want to ask you in a little bit, in a moment, about you know, your experience and the relationships that you're able to foster, like through DSA in that part of the world. But before I get to that, I just want to take another opportunity to ask you to sort of explain the gist of Pedro Castillo's campaign, like policy-wise, what it represented. And I'd really like if you could talk a little bit about the coalitions that were brought into power, because I know you and I have chatted a little bit about this privately, but it was amazing how almost immediately the story about Pedro Castillo in a lot of American left circles was, you know, this is some kind of red-brown alliance, right, with this like horrible social conservative monster, you know. And that wasn't the coalition that was being built. It was actually a really inspiring coalition that was bringing people who weren't very much represented by the political process before, and had a very strong working class message, and brought in a lot of the left organizations, left parties. Anyways, you're the one who went there and talked to all the folks and saw things on the ground. So please tell me what you saw.
Oh my goodness, so much to unpack there. And yes, the very, very important questions to touch upon here. So I think something that's so critical to point out, there's a couple things that are critical to point out here. Every feminist group we met with, every, you know, group we met from the gay community in Peru, they were all firmly supporting Pedro Castillo. Out of the two candidates, Pedro Castillo and Keiko Fujimori, only one of them met with members of the gay community, and it wasn't Keiko Fujimori, right? Keiko comes from the far right, from the evangelical far right, right? So my position is, us, especially us leftists in the United States, rather than talk over the gay community in Peru or talk over the feminist community in Peru, let's listen to them. If we are troubled by some of the things Pedro Castillo said in the past, let's listen to what the Peruvians who are actually going to live under his administration are saying, right? Let's see what their opinions are, right? And they were firmly behind Pedro Castillo. DSA's longest running historical partner in Peru is the party Nuevo Peru, right? Which is their politics are almost to a T the same as DSA, right? I would say, you know, democratic socialist. This is a feminist party. Once again, this is a pro LGBTQ+ party in Peru. Every single one of them firmly backing Castillo. There was a news story a couple weeks before the election where Pedro Castillo worked out a deal with Veronica Mendoza, the leader of the Renovo Peru party, saying, hey, we're going to, you know, get better on social issues and we can collaborate with, you know, let's work together. The priority is a new constitution, right? A constitution made by and for Peruvians, right? And this was a message that resonated with a lot of people in Peru. So I think it's critical to point that out. I think it's also critical to point out once again how this coalition, every single aspect of it mattered, right? Mm-hmm. Just look at that vote total. What did he win by? 50.2%. Like, we even met with some of the smaller parties, right? The Partido Comunista Patria Roja, right? Literally the party that was founded by the Peruvian Marxist Jose Carlos Mariátegui, right? The Communist Party of Peru. Even those small parties, if literally just one of them peeled off of this coalition, he probably wouldn't have won. So like, this truly was, it's such a remarkable story to see this candidate who basically came out of nowhere be able to have a message that was able to resonate so deeply to so many Peruvians that the entire left and entire progressive forces were able to come together in this movement to get this guy elected. And, you know, David, you asked me a little bit kind of about like Pedro Castillo's like politics himself or whatever. I think another important point to make here, and perhaps this might be, you know, my own opinion here, just from my interactions. I did get a chance to meet with Pedro Castillo as well, which was a very interesting experience. I don't know that this is a guy who's particularly motivated by ideology, to be completely honest, right? I see a lot of people trying to put different labels on him, whether it be negative labels like Machista, whether it be people on the left saying, this is a guy who's coming from, who's a Marxist-Leninist. Mm-hmm. His party is certainly kind of like Marxist-Leninist, but he himself, I don't know that I would say that about him, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know that this is a guy that's motivated by ideology. I think this is a guy who came from the teachers union movement, who looks around in his community and says, why the hell is everybody so poor, right, in a country that has so many resources, right? I think this is a person who truly is an organic reflection of the massive upheaval that just happened in Peru last year, right? Mm-hmm. I think, and I tie this to one of the biggest lessons that I draw for the left here in the United States from Peru, which is Pedro Castillo and Peru Libre, they were able to tap into that anger that manifested itself in protests that happened worldwide, right? I don't know. In fact, I'd say it's pretty clear to say that the left of the United States was not able to do that to the extent, mm-hmm. at least that happened in Peru, right? The massive protests that happened after the killing of George Floyd, right? Nationwide, mm-hmm. right? The left in the United States was not able to properly, you know, to tap into that anger in ways that I saw happen in Peru, right? Because Peru simultaneously had a massive protest upheaval where, like, God, they went through like three presidents in the span of like a year, which was insane in and of itself. But Pedro Castillo was able to tap into that, right, with his campaign platform. And once again, it was so amazing to see a community, a leftist movement, which has, God, you'd be hard pressed to find a left in this hemisphere that has been through as much as the Peruvian left has in the last few decades, right? That's probably an understatement, right? So it's just so amazing to see these people who have struggled for so long get this moment, right? And which is why it's so important to be pushing back against all this coup BS that's coming from the right wing. This it's a desperate attempt from Keiko Fujimori to stay out of prison, which, sorry Keiko, you're going back to prison. And yes, I'm an abolitionist, but it will be funny to see her go back to prison. Maybe that's been spirited, I don't know.
I'm down with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Well, lock her up.
There we go, now we're talking.
I think the stuff about DSA we can actually sort of pack in with Venezuela. And maybe Matt and I will just save this Oppenheimer. I don't know. Like, Austin, you're bringing a lot of like positive energy into this room right now, and I'm liking it. So I don't want to bring in any opinions from Miami.
Some goon.
Into this conversation right now. But I wanted to talk a little bit about your experience in Venezuela because, we're going to put the DSA conversation and kind of reflect as like American leftists at the second part. You go to Venezuela. Venezuela is a country that is extremely demonized in the United States. You know, a big repoussé of most DSA members is to say, oh, we don't support, I shouldn't say most DSA members, but a lot of people will make this argument. We don't support Venezuela, blah, blah, blah. There's not a lot of information and media coverage of what's going on in Venezuela, except for the most extremely biased stuff possible. You go into Venezuela,
And what was your experience? What did you, you know, what did you see? Who did you speak to? Just paint us a little bit of a picture here.
Oh, man. Okay. Once again, a lot to unpack here. I think it's important to take a little bit of a step back here. Once again, from the U.S. left perspective, right? You know, DSA was, just a couple thousand members pre-Donald Trump, right? Mm-hmm. After the giant membership boom that has happened in DSA, a lot of our internal structures have gone through a process of catching up with that boom, right? Mm-hmm. I would say that this is the beginning of our international committee and our kind of like foreign policy wing, whatever we want to call it, beginning to catch up with the structures, right? And that means coordinating internationally with other leftist movements, other socialist movements throughout our hemisphere, throughout the world, right? I also, I think I might have mentioned this the last time I was on, I don't remember. I was also in London in 2019 for their elections, which, good God, that was depressing to see Boris Johnson win. But we've also done these sorts of things in Europe, right? This was the first time we sent an official delegation of this sort to a place like Venezuela. And it was, oh man, to say it was an interesting experience, that's like the understatement of the century, right? We met with, so the reason we went down there was to attend the Bicentennial Congress of the Peoples, is what it was called. Now, what this Congress was for was it was essentially an international gathering celebrating the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Carabobo, led by Simon Bolivar, which basically guaranteed Venezuelan independence, right? So it wasn't just DSA down there. There was plenty of different international left groups, plenty of different prominent international leftists. Mm-hmm. I had the honor of having a brief little moment with Evo Morales in the hotel lobby, which was amazing. Hilarious, right? I met with... in fact, something I know that we did talk about the last time I was on, we talked a bit about Ecuador. I met Jaime Vargas, the now former president of CONAIE, who was a major character during everything that was happening in Ecuador at the time. We met with a lot of different international groups. I think this is so critical for members of the United States left, right? And this is why, yeah, and something I know that you both are going to share, this is why Michael Brooks was such an important voice in the U.S. left, because of his stances on foreign policy, right? More people on the U.S. left should be as bold as Michael Brooks was, right? And I think this is the beginning of people seeing a group like DSA go to Venezuela and thinking, okay, maybe Venezuela isn't the boogeyman that I've been told it is, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not to say Venezuela doesn't have its problems, right? Of course it has its problems. It's a government, right? I don't understand anybody who either stands a government, right, or uniquely vilifies a government, right? There are successes and failures we can learn from them, right? And it was remarkable to me to hear from the average Venezuelan how nuanced their opinion was on the political situation, right? I don't know that we met a single person who was like, ah, yes, we love Maduro and long live the revolution, right? Every opinion was very nuanced. It was, yeah, this government has issues, right? But this is the government that is supporting the commune project, right? This is the government that is trying to carry the revolution forward. Revolution's not easy. Revolution's messy, believe it or not. It's not linear, dare I say, right?
It's not a button that you press. Right. Or a decree. Exactly. Right. You don't write it on the piece of paper. It's like, okay, we're a communist or like we're a socialist country now. Right. Like Trump style, and like put in front of the cameras and then everything changes. It's a process, something that you build. Right. Anyways.
Yes. No, you're exactly right. Like something, an example I like to use is that, like, if we had elected Bernie president, right, it's not like he could just, as you say, click the socialism button, right? There's quite a lot of steps that would have to be taken to get us to a place to even get, you know, Medicare for all, things like that, right? So once again, I think it's so important to go to these places where, okay, well, the left has been in government, right? What struggles have they faced? What lessons can they give us, right? What pitfalls can we try and hope to avoid? And I think I go back to the meeting with the commies, right? Because to me, these are some of the purest like expressions of socialism, like in our time, right? And it's interesting.
You said the communes, right?
Yes, the communes. Okay. For me, the communes are some of the most purest expressions of socialism in our time, right? And like for me, and just a little bit about the communes themselves, right? These are communities in Venezuela that literally are taking the role of the state. Like, I cannot emphasize that enough. Before I went to Venezuela, I only had a conception of the communes as like, or the conception I had of the communes were based off of some of the more famous ones, like El Maizal, which is a giant like corn commune where they produce corn, which is very important for the Venezuelan diet, right? I knew about the pioneros, right? The pioneers who like build their own homes, who are like squatters that have like taken over land. What I learned is how many of these communes, they do everything, right? They manufacture and produce corn. They build houses. They clean up their communities. They provide security for their communities. They are almost forced to fulfill the role of the state because the state has been so devastated by the blockade and the sanctions and the unilateral coercive measures that global capital has imposed on Venezuela. It's amazing. I came to a Venezuela that has learned how to get by under sanctions. And how have they learned to do that? Because of things like the communes, because of these communities, once again, full of hate. It's amazing. You know, I even phrase it this way, which perhaps, I don't know, is maybe a bit dramatic, but it truly is what it felt like. You literally see the withering away of the state, so to speak, in real time. And it's an amazing thing to see. And I think there's once again, so much to be learned. I don't know if I'm cutting in and out, but my Wi-Fi might be messing up here.
You were, but it was, we got the general gist of it. I think it's important if nothing else. And this is why I really thought that all the things you were seeing on Twitter, for example, of DSA members who were there just sharing pictures and videos and things like that. Just being able to push through a lot of the nonsense and the portrayals of Venezuela to understand what it actually is. Because, like, let's imagine for a second that there wasn't like a media, like, okay, there's the actual blockade, but there wasn't also a media blockade, right? There would be a lot of interesting and nuanced conversations to have about Venezuela and the project there, right? But what we're especially saying right now is that you don't even see anything there. The ability to have any kind of nuanced conversation or understanding of it is extremely hampered. And one thing that I thought that was so good about this moment was I've always felt sooner or later, especially as DSA and the American left becomes a little bit more international, people were going to have to sort of come face to face with the way that a lot of American leftists think and talk about the rest of the world. Some people were asking us about the media coverage about Venezuela, about like the DSA delegation to Venezuela, and pretty much all that I saw, and correct me if I'm wrong, was just, you know, the right wingers having a field day. But I felt it was a good moment for at least people to start getting a little bit stronger and just start working those muscles of being able to talk intelligently about Venezuela instead of just doing the traditional like denying game, because that really hurts our ability to stand with our other comrades across the hemisphere, right? If everyone else is having a certain position on this kind of thing, and the American leftists are the ones that are so holy and mighty, right? Who don't have very much state power, real serious ambitions of taking it here right now. We're the ones that are too, you know, clean to talk about Venezuela or to have solidarity with everyone else on the continent. I think that that's a problem. But so you were able to see the communes, and could you talk about sort of the conversations that were being had between, you know, the DSA delegations and other like left organizations and groups and folks that y'all were meeting, activists and organizers?
Sure, absolutely. Not only so this that I'm going to say, the reaction that we would get from other delegations was not just limited to them. Reaction we also got from average people, which is such excitement to meet with friends from the United States, right? Because as you've kind of touched upon, David, the United States, members of the left in the United States have kind of avoided this space for too long, right?
Yeah.
And this happened in Peru as well. People were so happy to meet with people from the United States. People were just like, what, you're from the United States? Oh my, like, it was an amazing thing to see. And like, I think I think this is, at least in my mind, this is only the beginning of that, or at least I hope so. You know, perhaps this might surprise people to hear. You mentioned the conversation that happened on like Twitter or in the news media. I was happy to see this. I saw ideological growth. I saw debate. I saw conversation, right? I'd rather us confront our contradictions on this and try and hash this out rather than like, okay, let's just hide this in the closet and not even act like this is a thing. No, let's actually have this conversation. Let's see what we think about this. Let's grow ideologically. And personally, dare I say, I enjoy doing things that piss off Elliot Abrams personally and ruin his day and force him to write some blog piece. I enjoy doing things that make their chair of the Republican Party put out a tweet saying, oh my God, the DSA, right? We should take pride in that. Personally, I say we should be happy that we ruined Elliot Abrams' day, I would say. But going back to the core of your question there, because I just had to get that one out. No, delegations were so happy to see DSA there, right? We're so happy to, obviously, it wouldn't surprise anybody to know that one of the first things that a lot of delegations would ask is this, oh my God, Ocasio-Cortez, do you guys know her? That sort of thing, right? Because it's amazing to see how amazing and well-known AOC is as just a worldwide figure. Like, it's anybody who thinks, oh, is she really furthering the cause of socialism? Tell that to these people who see her as a major inspiration basically anywhere you go, at least anywhere I went. It was truly remarkable to see.
No, I mean, that's such an interesting point too. And like, for people to realize what the US left looks like from the outside too. Right. And where people are seeing the moments and the movements. I think that's a really interesting perspective.
Can you just talk about getting, along those lines, like the perspective offered by looking outside of electoral politics in the States, like for instance, like rewriting a Fujimori constitution, right? There are limits we all know to electoralism. When you get a mass sort of mandate to do something like that, that is amazing. And talk about that.
Sure. That's to me one of the things that's unique. You know, you use the example of the Constitution. To me, that's one of the unique things about the left, at least in Latin America, right? They have been able to, in some places, in Peru, in Venezuela, right? What was Chavez's campaign slogan in 1998 or 1999, right? We're going to rewrite the Constitution, right? They are able to truly use these electoral campaigns to make systemic change happen. This is why I go back to what I say earlier. There's a lot of lessons to be drawn from this. It makes me sad whenever I see people who uphold the democratic socialist tradition, in my mind, turning a blind eye to some of the most successful democratic socialist projects of our time, like almost literally, right? So like, it's amazing to see what's happening in Chile right now as well. Very similarly, you know, movement to change the Constitution. Now, I know that's perhaps a more awkward conversation in the United States, where the Constitution is the Bible and holy, and that I don't know how a movement to change the Constitution would look here. But I think there's so many lessons to be drawn between like actually using an electoral campaign to make actual, dare I say, revolutionary change happen. I would call what happened in Venezuela a revolution when Chavez was elected and was able to change the Constitution, right? What is happening in Chile right now? That is a revolution, right? They are shredding the Pinochet Constitution as we speak, right? Beautiful. And in Peru, if they're able to do the same, they truly are on the cusp of a revolution. Let's just think about that for a second. Peru, this is the Lima Group, the right-wing alliance, is capitaled in Peru, right? If we could get Peru to shred, if the Peruvians can get Peru to shred the Fujimori Constitution and create something new, to say that is like, that would change the region is an understatement, which is why, you know, I go back to why this is so important for people in the United States to be paying attention to. It's so important for people in the United States to be supporting this. So important for people in the United States to be actively resisting these coup efforts that are very, very real. Because once again, this is the beginning of, I don't know if we want to call it the resurgence of the Pink Tide. I'm a little biased and would say maybe it was never gone, and the death of the Pink Tide narrative was a bit of a kind of like ephemeral narrative that was sort of forced through things such as the way they took down the PT in Brazil, right? These manufactured, like Lava Jato, right? These manufactured corruption scandals, because fundamentally the Pink Tide, it's not Chavez, it's not Lula, it's not Castillo, it's the people, right? And you can do your best. Look at Bolivia, right? You can do your best to get rid of Evo. The people haven't forgotten all the gains that were made under Mas, right? You can do your best to get rid of those figureheads. You can do your best to divide the left in Ecuador, right? The fact of the matter is that the people remember the way things were under these leftist governments, right? And that's not going to go away, right? The Pink Tide is why, once again, the Pink Tide, we can say it's back, but I would say it was never gone in the first place. But I'm biased.
I love that. And like, especially like regarding Evo, that's like such a critical point as like, you know, you saw under the coup government, like, you know, you can even say like, okay, Evo starts to like drift away. Like, I'm just devil's advocate for a second. He drifts away. He doesn't have the deepest connections with folks. But the moment that the people needed to be called upon, the people were there because the organization had been done. The contacts were there. The memory was there. And that's the kind of political organizing that people need to start to recognize. We have to be building here too, because it's not just building the right platform. Though I will say we have learned from Pedro Castillo that a good gimmick can go a long way with the pencil. you know,
I'm taking that.
What?
I'm using the pencil emoji from now on.
Oh, it's so perfect. You know, we have to be building that. Yeah. In just the last second, before you head out, I just wanted to
to hear you respond to this, specifically with Peru, but also in Venezuela, because there were some people who were like, I hate to even bring it up, but, you know, we're basically, oh, this is just like a great time for like middle class Americans to go on a fun tour and good Latin American, you know, vacation. Could you talk about, one, how critical the role you would say of the international observers was in Peru, and also, you know, what you think some of the more material movements or just like understandings that were gained from DSA being in Venezuela, you know, lay something out of those critics who said this was just like a fun trip that was paid for you and your friends to go visit Latin America.
Here's what I would say. I come from a working class background, right? I would have loved to visit Machu Picchu while I was in Peru. I would have loved to go to the big falls in Venezuela while I was there. We didn't do that. You want to know why? We were literally working the whole damn time, right? The whole time in both instances, it was impossible to do anything but work with other leftists, network with the actual people. In Peru, election observing itself, once again, we spent our entire time in Lima, literally because we could not go anywhere else. And even while we were in Lima, I did not do even a second of sightseeing, right? The entire time was spent working with the people. The entire time was spent talking to people. And similarly in Venezuela, our entire time was spent, the vast majority, like we didn't even spend that much time in Venezuela talking to government officials. The vast majority of time was spent talking to the communes. I lost count of how many communes we met with, right? Wow. Communes, not just in Caracas. We were also able to meet some in the rural communities, right? Some of the rural communes, which was an amazing experience, right? I met with communes that were so amazing that I have never even heard of, right? Wow. These are people that people in the United States don't even know exist, right? And it's amazing to me, once again, what they are able to do in their communities where the state is unable to provide any sort of support because of how crippled the state has become. So once again, to anybody who thinks that we took a vacation, part of me wishes we did, right? Because I would love to go see these sites, but that we were unable to.
No, I think that kind of allegation was just BS, and a lot of people who are sitting on the sidelines being very jealous.
Sure.
You at least got some good Venezuelan or Peruvian food, though, while you were
there. Oh, I'm still dreaming about the ceviche I had in Peru. Oh my goodness. And I tweeted about this. Here's the thing. I know about arepas, right? The national food of Venezuela. And I know tequeños, right? I'm of Puerto Rican descent. There's a lot of Venezuelans selling tequeños in Puerto Rico. What I did not know about, cachapas. Whoo! You want to try something delicious? Here's the thing, like a lot of foods in Latin America, right? A lot of it is okay. Let's see exactly what we can stuff inside of this tortilla. Same concept, except instead of tortilla, this was made of like pancake. So you had like a pancake with like steak, eggs, all these delicious things packed inside there. It was. I'm getting hungry just thinking about it.
Good I know, morning. Man. I haven't had dinner yet, so you're getting me going.
Well, exactly. Me too.
Well, Austin, it's such a treat to have you on.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. Happy. Once again, thank you so much for having me back on. And I'm always happy to come on in the future as well.
No, for sure.
Thanks, Austin. Check out Machete y Mate, everybody. Go subscribe to that now. And I accidentally went to break. They can still hear us, but we'll see. See you later, folks. We'll see you in a few minutes while we sign off.
That's the problem, man. Oh, no, yeah. That's the problem, please.
All right, are we back? Streamlabs just had a little hiccup there. Hopefully everything's okay.
No, we're back. We're back.
Okay, cool.
Appreciate it, everybody. That was a lot of fun hanging out with Austin.
Austin's great. Austin and the boys, T, and I'm forgetting the other guy's name who has the quiet mic, but they do just a great show. I think it's perfectly my speed, where it's like hosts that are very familiar with each other and know each other's like personalities well, but also have very good knowledge of what they're talking about.
I wanted to make a quick programming note too to folks, because we had been, there is a lot that is happening in Brazil right now. Obviously the long-term positioning of Lula, you know, as he hopefully is able to, you know, retain and regain his position as president of the country and finally kick out the clown fascist, Bolsonaro, more corruption allegations. What's looking like it might be a very strange and crowded presidential field. It's one of those things when you're looking at Brazil, it's like every time you start preparing a show, some kind of new bombshell happens. We're going to be joined by our friend Victor Pucci, who was supposed to be joining us today, but we had a little bit of a scheduling conflict. We're going to be having a conversation with him soon, and we're going to be releasing that for patrons over the weekend. And that's going to be a very in-depth conversation about what's going on in Brazil today and what the long-term outlet is looking like. And if you want to get access to that conversation early, please join us at patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Yeah, now let's move to another assassination, this one where we know who did it, finally, and legally it's been established. It was David Castillo. Now, who is David Castillo and who did he murder? Berta Caceres was murdered in 2016 in Honduras. She was one of the leading Honduran environmental activists. She was the leader of the Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations, which... just the sound of that sounds great. That sounds like a great council. Popular and indigenous organizations, sign me up. So she was a threat to DESA, an energy corporation that was running that wanted to put a big dam in the Aqua Zarca Dam project, which would have occupied Lenca land, the indigenous folks that Caceres is a member of. There's this great article in The Intercept on this, the system that killed Berta Caceres. And I want to play a little bit about that. Just like the she was opposing this dam project, which would have flooded a lot of their land, and she was killed for it, right? Which would remind people, I'm sure it's not just the Upper Missouri Valley, but it's the one I know of because I'm from North Dakota, of Pick Sloan, which was a Missouri River damming project, which put up a whole bunch of dams along the Missouri River, all of which basically flooded native land. There's a town in North Dakota called Newtown, and the reason they had to make a new town was because of that flooding. So this is a very, like, when we talk about hydro, which is going to become more and more popular because it basically serves as a battery for energy, retaining these water, and battery technology is difficult to master, you know, see lithium. It's not just moving away from lithium and hard earth minerals. Like, dams are massively problematic too, as this case and, you know, our history has shown. But not to get too off a field there, here's a little bit from... this Intercept piece, and I wanted to share a few sections of it here. Give me 1 second. 1:30 here. Okay, here we are. Again, I highly recommend this entire...
Berta Caceres sparked international condemnation.
And do we know who killed her or why?
It wasn't hard to guess the kind of broad reasons why somebody in Honduras would want to have Berta Caceres killed. Her activism often created problems for business interests and for members of the ruling class.
Caceres complained of death threats from police and the army in the past. Her daughter says her mother was killed because she refused to exploit natural resources at the expense of native people.
In the final years of her life, she was fighting an effort to construct a dam on the Gualcarque River by a company called Desarrollos Energéticos Sociedad Anónima, or DESA. That's the company you just mentioned a moment ago.
The dam had wealthy international investors, and the government was determined to push ahead.
And they wanted to construct a dam over this river where the Lenca people have a lot of territories and use the water.
It would have cut off the water supply to the Lenca community and the land they live off.
So for background on this case, in 2005, there was a presidential election in Honduras. The winner was a businessman named Manuel Zelaya, sometimes known by his nickname Mel.
Jorge Mel, gana Honduras, ganas tú.
Zelaya was elected on a liberal platform, but moved to the left during his presidency. While he was president, he prioritized Honduras's agricultural production to reduce reliance on imports and joined a Venezuelan-led regional trade group called the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas. And most crucially, he sought this constitutional change, which would have facilitated the redistribution of wealth from the hands of 10 ruling families who...
Just to zoom up a little before, basically, he was couped. The Obama and Hillary Clinton both personally described it as a coup, but the State Department somehow never got around to acting on it as if it was a coup and doing anything about it. Do you have anything you want to say there, Dave, before we move on a little bit here? There's another clip here. We didn't quite get to it, but where they're, after this happened, Honduras is open for business was their big slogan. I also want to put it two things. So David Castillo was the president and CEO of DESA, the company that was putting this dam in. And he was, I want to share this quick. We got some more fun here, or happiness, I guess I shouldn't say fun. Coming up from the very best. Okay. Sorry, that audio is not great. But so David Castillo is found guilty of assassination for ordering this hit on this activist. And the one thing that I believe the daughter of Berta has said that she wants to stress is that we don't want... This is amazing. This is a great, bit of justice. This can't just be a one-off, because there's activists under threat all the time in Honduras, mm-hmm. in the exact same way. So, like, this is great, and this needs to be, like, to set a sort of pattern recognition for folks about what's happening. Not that, oh, thank God, now everything's, sorted out.
Yeah, I think that is such an important statement. And obviously, I mean, this is justice that has been delayed, for a very long time. And I think it's incredible to finally get the person who's calling out the hit in trouble. But remember, these are long form conspiracies behind these kind of actions. And what I want to note here is that, a lot of people use this story in the 2016 election to remind people of how corrupt and evil Hillary Clinton is. And I think that that's certainly correct. But this is one of those moments where you can get so fixated on the personal, on the individual, and you miss the structural things here, right? This is not forgiving Hillary Clinton by any stretch of the imagination. But what I want to remind people of is that Clinton's role, right, in this coup against Zelaya, should remind people that it's not just like leftism or like socialism that is a direct threat to American empire. It's like basic developmental statism. Right. Like in the sense of like, oh, I want to develop my economy in a way that benefits the people in my society, most notably the working people, and not the people at the very top of my society and, multinational, international corporations. Right. That kind of politics. So even if it's just liberal, right, not even anti-capitalist, is a direct threat to American hegemony and imperialism. And Hillary Clinton made a choice in her life to be a foot soldier for that system. Right. And we should judge her for that forever. But remember that these things are very, very, they're much larger than just personal egos and, this kind of thing. Some people have more fervor and passion for evil and wickedness than others. But there's a reason that Hillary Clinton was making these kind of decisions that led to, you know, more devastation in Honduras, and unfortunately, you know, to the murder of Berta.
Let's I also want to play just a little bit more from this, because I love that they got these call logs, and I think they're pretty illuminating as far as the mindset of the people who order assassinations of activists.
Who would later be charged and sentenced with the murder of Berta Cáceres. That call log wasn't only looked at by us. It was first examined during public prosecutor's office in their trying of the hitman who would later be charged and sentenced with the murder of Berta Cáceres. That call log wasn't only looked at by us. It was first examined by an independent expert, and it showed, and her analysis of those chats showed, that the assassins had communicated through a compartmentalized chain that reached the highest ranks of leadership of the company. And so we looked at those messages to show how they demonstrated a plot to kill Cáceres. And they also demonstrated Dessa's involvement in other unethical activities, like bribing journalists covering the story, spying on activists and diplomatic meetings, and keeping tabs on Berta's location. And so we can see that on July 15th, 2013. So that very day, one of the leaders, Atala Midens, sent a message to Castillo, who at the time was the president of DESA. And he texted him in Spanish, "The military killed an Indio." And he said, "It looks like another of them is dead." In response to that, Castillo said, "Pay the reporter from HCH, which is a Honduran news station." And he said how much they would pay him. He went as far as that. He said, 1,000 lempiras for last week. And right now we can give him another 1,000. Oh, so that amounts to about $100. And we know that when that television program ran the story, the broadcast was slanted in Dessa's favor. They mentioned that the child of someone working on the dam had been killed and indicated that members of COPIN were responsible. However, that has been widely disputed. And
right. So, I mean, it's just fascinating how that works, right? Just to say, like, the things you suspect, but just, in Indio, as they say, the anti-Indigenous, just racism, white supremacy, another $100 to get this journalist to cover for us. Yeah.
I mean, it's extremely important to be able to shed light on these things. It's just such a devastating, story, and a realization of the seriousness of this fight, because they were very powerful people,
killers
trying to continue to murder and to choke the planet.
Yeah. Well, David, anything else we need to business we need to complete before we get to the post game?
Yeah, I think we should talk about this Assange briefly, because this is a very important story for folks. Everybody knows the name Julian Assange, but remember, when we're talking about this kind of journalism that The Intercept is doing in this case, these kind of things, this kind of brave journalism of exposing these secrets, of exposing these networks that have the ability to sweep these things under the rug, right? That's an incredible service to democracy. And I'm not even going to do the typical Assange disclaimers. At this point, people should know the way that the board is set. And what is going on against Julian Assange right now is a continuation of an attempt to stifle democracy and journalism. And it is certainly an attack on his basic human rights. The United States right now has been granted the ability to appeal a decision by the United Kingdom that found that if Assange was extradited to the United States, that his human rights would be under severe threat, right? And I want people to think about that for a moment too. What that says about the American justice system, that the little island of Boris Johnson folks are sitting here saying that him coming over here and facing criminal proceedings in the United States would threaten his very human rights. The Biden administration is trying to present a different story or painting to the United Kingdom, arguing that they would not hold Julian Assange in the most austere conditions that they have, which is just a disgusting admission in the first place of how our justice system works. and that they would even potentially consider allowing Assange to live out the length of his sentence in Australia. I'm going to tell you right now, that sentence would be a life sentence. They're going to throw, and they intend to throw everything that they can at Julian Assange. And let's also not forget that, you know, as all these proceedings are going on, Assange has been held. You know, this has been a long ongoing legal process against him that has stifled him, has shut him up, and has, you know, and has confronted him with incredible. I mean, I can't even imagine the personal suffering of somebody like Julian Assange to have both of these states, you know, basically trying to come at him and throw the book at him with the full force that they have at their disposal. So note this, because these developments are really important. And Matt, if you have this story from Common Dreams, I wanted to note a couple of things, because as all of this is happening, we're finding out more and more and more about the facade that this case was built on. So Assange supporters demand release amid key DOG witnesses' admission testimony was fabricated, and it was written by Julia Conley in Common Dreams. I'm going to scroll down a little bit because the first bit is that, you know, Assange's family and friends celebrated his 50th birthday outside of Belmarsh Prison, where he's being, outside of Parliament. But he's being held in Belmarsh Prison. If you scroll down a little bit, the rally came a week after a key witness in the United States government's case, against Assange, Sigurdur Ingi Thordarson, apologies if I didn't get that right, admitted that his entire testimony is false in an article in the Icelandic news outlet Stundin. The article details how Thordarson, a convicted felon, this is, you know, their stuff, pedophile and sociopath, used his position to steal money from WikiLeaks and received immunity from prosecution from the FBI in a quid pro quo, Fair reported, noting the new information received virtually no coverage from the corporate media. Jennifer Robinson, a legal advisor to Assange, appeared on Democracy Now! Earlier this week to discuss the development, calling Thordarson's admission just the latest revelation to demonstrate why the United States case should be dropped. And it certainly should. This is something that, it's one of those stories that I know a lot of people on the left have sympathy with Assange, but it's one of those things where the slow drag of this story allows more and more egregious examples and subversion of justice to happen, right? Because it's easy to take your eye off the ball with the Assange trial at this point, because it's been going on for so long. But you should remind yourself, you know, if you think it's been going on for a very long time, imagine what it's been like for him and his loved ones and his family. And also remember that this is a direct threat to democracy and justice in just the clearest sense. This is like a textbook case. This is the kind of story, if you wanted to write a story for a child to understand what government censorship looks like, what government's trying to intimidate journalists looks like, you would tell them this story.
Right. And can you just tell folks what was recanted, the nature of the information, just what specifically?
Yeah, so I believe what was recanted here was that this gentleman said that Assange gave him the order to hack MPs' computers. And what this person has now recanted is saying, oh, I did not get that order. And also, it appears, to my knowledge, that this person also recanted or basically contradicted themselves in how deep their relationship was with Assange and WikiLeaks itself, because I believe he was just a volunteer, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody who would be a very easy mark.
Let me just cut in and say, like, yeah, if he's a convicted pedophile, that seems like the type of person who is an intelligence asset and yeah, who... what was recanted, and that, and the thing about Assange, like, the hacking charge versus, like, as mm-hmm. a way to basically prosecute journalism, right? I don't care if Assange taught somebody, like, coding, like, did an extensive, like, I to me, like, this doesn't fucking matter. Like, this ultimately, absolutely, the disclosure of information should be protected, 100%. This way around it, where it's the same thing as, like, mail fraud, right? Like if you use the mail to send like some information back in the day, if that's how they got, I don't even know.
Wire fraud. Yeah.
Right. Like I wonder if that was even protected under the First Amendment. Like this is it. To be honest, this is like the same thing.
Well, I mean, and this is classic American bullshit. I mean, this is exactly the same kind of thing that's happened with Leonard Peltier, where the FBI has come in and intimidated people and said, hey, you're going to say to the judge that you saw him doing this, this and that, that you saw him wearing this, that you saw him with this kind of gun. Right. I mean, these are documented at this point. That the FBI was doing this against Leonard Peltier, and that's not the only example, just one that's coming to my head right now, right? Like, this is a tactic that is used time and time again by the state to try to get their way in, something that is supposedly supposed to be objective, we all know.
There's a gun planted on Red Fawn Phallus. Collins Catch the Bear is a name. I don't know that story off the top of my head, but I think another Fed Informa type situation. Like this stuff, yeah, like it's the playbook, right? Like, and it never stopped. It's like, what? Yeah, I don't know what else to say.
And just as a cherry, it has to be stated again. Remember, what was exposed was not just gossip, it was legitimate war crimes committed by the United States in an imperialist war. And if you can't recognize that that is the focus and the reason that they are challenging Assange, if you are too fixated on, for example, the 2016 election, that you forget, they don't care about, like, maybe, Clinton, if she were to be president, might be really pissed off and want to be targeting Assange, right, for the email leaks, right? The reason the state is coming after Julian Assange, right, and which, again, I would defend him in that moment too, because that would equally be absurd. But the reason that the state is coming after Julian Assange is that he exposed imperialist war crimes and an American adventure in the Middle East. And they did not want that information to be public.
I mean, the WikiLeaks cable we had, cited at the top of the show about Haiti, but we're just going to have the ambassador on behalf of fucking Haynes. I mean, how a clear line can you draw, right? The U.S. ambassador saying, hey, this minimum wage thing, no, because Haynes told me not to.
Yeah.
And, or it's contractors as like all the, maybe this is a disclaimer we should put in here too, because that's the one, like all the newspapers that covers it, it's like, it's the contractors that did this. Yeah. Okay. It's
insane.
Yeah. And also, another thing about like when, like that, like we're forced exploitation in another country, right? It's not like the countries that didn't force that aren't benefiting, right? Like if Nike all of a sudden doesn't have to compete for the non-Haitian product, that's a leveraging point. They can go to this one. Hey, you know how we both Haynes and we were competing for your inputs there, commodities? Well, now that they are going to Haiti to get that, so guess what happens to your price? Like, this is a basic sort of understanding that I think was maybe more common like when slavery existed as a way to like do a cross people that are enslaved and also worker solidarity, but it's just like it's an obvious thing, and this thing where it's like, no, it's not us, it's our contractors, like, no, it's you and everyone else in your fucking industry.
Exactly. And exposing that's important work anyway. Solidarity with Assange and with journalists threatened by state abuse anywhere. Please join us in the post game at patreon.com/leftreckoning. Matt has some very fun clips and sounds, I believe, set up for us. I think we're also going to watch a vintage TMBS clip of us talking about CLR James, which I think is important to just sort of frame our conversation earlier. Anything else we should be plugging?
Yeah, we're going to be talking about Donnie Deutsch. We're going to be talking about an interesting new Claire McCaskill 4th of July family tradition. I don't know if you saw this, David. If
no,
not, you're in for a treat.
I can't wait.
I wonder if you could guess what it is. Can you guess what that tradition might be? Claire McCaskill.
Cheese balls.
Cheese balls. I mean, you're giving her way too much credit. It's way more resistance bullshit than that.
Okay.
We're going to be talking about the purpose of Spotify and there's some fun stuff on this.
Yeah, anyway. And also
I think we're also going to try to talk a little bit about this Exxon stuff. Exxon lobbyists.
Oh, yeah.
Spills the beans. And, you know, we'll talk about this other thing, but I love this clip so much because people who haven't met lobbyists don't know the kind of character. Like, obviously, they're sickos and all that kind of stuff, but they're also just so vain that you can really get them going about a lot of stuff. So it's a very fun clip. We'll be hanging out and also taking your questions. So join us at patreon.com/leftreckoning.
All right, patrons, we'll see you in about a half hour. Peace out.